Welcome to the Mo Show podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in across our audio platforms. Just before we kick off, a reminder to download the CAFT app. We have linked it in the show notes across YouTube and the audio platforms. It'll really elevate your experience once you're within CAFT. I've lived a life without it, then with it, and I've realized that it just made my life so much easier in navigating my way through CAFT with the app. So give that a shot when you get a chance. Yesterday, we had some big news coming out. We partnered up with our newest sponsor, Noon. Noon is a leading digital commerce platform in the Middle East. I'll tell you about their two latest services in Saudi Arabia, Noon Minutes and Supermall. Noon Minutes, as the name says, they deliver thousands of products in just 15 minutes, whether it's groceries, household appliances, or even electronics. No one does it faster. And then we have Supermall, the ultimate destination for fast premium shopping, whether it's the latest tech, skincare essentials, or everyday must-haves. Noon has you covered, so stay tuned for more and enjoy the episode.
MashaAllah, tabarakAllah. I mean, in the glory days before 9/11, anybody could write their name, address, and the Saudi cultural mission would send them a box in Ramadan, three different kinds of dates. Mushaf, Sajada, Book of Dua, for free.
In the U.S. It's crazy. Yeah.
And we had a university.
Yeah.
In Virginia. For free.
It's crazy.
So, you know, me.
People don't talk about that. You know, that doesn't make headlines.
Exactly.
It's not incriminating enough to make headlines.
Exactly. Exactly. And I've been one of the, on this soil and in America, I was one of, even when I was a student, I've been a big, you can say, champion for the kingdom. Because I was one of the people growing up, whenever the media would bash something, I would look the other way. What is it? What is it? Why? Why are they so giving us this picture? So I would make my own decision. Mm. And I've always been that. That's how I get, to be honest, it's kind of how I got to Islam, making my own decision. Yeah.
Surreal. Full circle as well.
Yeah,
we ordered some. I don't even know why we're not rolling. I mean, this is rollable material. I should have asked you what Abdullah wants to drink. We have some coffee coming from Tim Hortons. Do you drink coffee?
Yeah.
Okay.
Love coffee.
Are you okay with either? I got two of each, so
either or.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, we'll wait till it comes.
I'm a black coffee guy, though.
Awesome. So yeah. There's two of them. Abdullah is going to have one, which means you can take the cappuccino. I couldn't find cold matcha. Your drink. Oh, he's here. Let me grab it. I'll come. Well, thank you so much for sparing me. Couple of hours, on Ramadan nights. I know there's so much happening. Ramadan is very few hours in the day for us to do things like, you know, record. But thank you so much for making time for me. Your story is a unique one. It's a very compelling one. I can relate to a few of your experiences, only a few. I certainly can't relate to the bulk of it, which we're going to get into today. In doing my research leading up to this episode, I read somewhere that you, I just can't believe it, but you had a gun pulled on you at the age of 14 once. And I said I want to open with that because that's has like trauma written all over it.
Mm-hmm. You know?
What exactly happened that you found yourself in a position where somebody pulled a gun on you at the age of 14?
So I think this was about 1986, and there was an event at UCLA. I think they call it the Mardi Gras. So me and two friends of mine, we asked our parents if we could go. They said we could go, and it's just a typical, you know, kind of like fairground event. There's food, there's rides, there's different things. And just to let the audience know, and at that particular time is the peak of or this is when LA gets its fame for gang violence. So two different gangs started fighting each other.
Blood in the Crips.
Yeah. Okay. People start funneling out of the campus onto the street. And me and my friends were walking down the street. And then another two different groups start flaring up. And as soon as the guy gets out of his car and reaches under the seat, which we didn't know. There was undercover police officers walking with us to Wilshire Boulevard. And soon as I looked around, boom, he's got that big, dirty, hairy, you know, long barrel revolver in my face. And he said, if you move, you know, I'll blow your head off.
Wow.
And I was traumatized by that. And I remember as soon as they let us go, we ran to the nearest hotel. And I called my my stepmom and told her what happened. And she's like, well, you guys just get home. And I know telling that to people is, you know, especially from this part of the world, it's kind of a strange thing. But unfortunately, at that particular time, it was something that was kind of normal.
Normal.
Yeah, unfortunately, just because of the level of the gang violence. I went to a junior high school on Wilshire Boulevard, not too far from this place, called John Burroughs Junior High School. We had armed guards. We had, you know, there's an old 80s, maybe early 90s television show called 21 Jump Street.
Yeah, I remember it.
We had 21 Jump Street in my school.
That's great.
Which are people that are young police officers that look young enough to pose as students. And the reason why is because at John Burroughs Junior High School, you had kids that were having $200, $300, $400 in their pockets every day, because as gangs are rising in this particular time, 1986, crack cocaine is being flooded into the streets. And it's catching everybody. It's not just catching drug dealers and gang members. The money is too fast that normal people are getting involved in it. And so that's why I say it was kind of normal. Still traumatizing, but it was normal. I didn't realize how traumatized I was until my parents were divorced. And my parents decided to get me out of LA and back to Seattle. And that's when I used to have the nightmares and kind of moments where if I heard a siren, I'd have a strange reaction, because you would hear gunshots and sirens. And the thing that is really strange about Los Angeles is, like, if I were to take you in a car and drive around these neighborhoods, these are beautiful neighborhoods, palm trees, beautiful homes. You know, nowadays those homes don't go less than $600,000, $700,000 in the area I'm talking about. So we're not talking about, not to shoot down New York, we're not talking about tenement buildings, projects in Chicago and Detroit. We're talking about Los Angeles. And so it's this dichotomy of this beautiful place, but it's been infiltrated by gangs and drugs.
And that was its heyday, yeah? In the late 80s, that's when Bloods and the Crips were at its highest. You said drugs were flooding the streets. It was one of the worst times to be in your adolescent years on the streets of LA.
Very dangerous. Very dangerous. I mean, I was a latchkey kid that I have kids now. I can't even imagine doing that now as a parent in that environment. It's like, no way. That's how times have changed.
It's almost like you're talking about something that's like 100 years ago. What's crazy is that it's only 30, 40 years ago.
That's right.
And how much times have changed.
That's right.
Yeah. The States had it bad. I remember New York City as well around that same time.
Oh, yes.
It was a shit show.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Similar to what's happening now, unfortunately. It's just a different situation. But our major cities are dying. There's just no doubt about it. If you look at Seattle, New York, Los Angeles, San Diego.
Even San Diego, my beloved San Diego.
Yeah, beautiful San Diego.
It's getting some heat as well. Yeah?
Oh, yeah. The drugs are just, you know. Yeah.
How tough was it for you being the eldest of your siblings?
There was a lot of pressure to succeed, to do the right thing. A lot of pressure to succeed, graduate from high school, go to college. You know, these are the things that were constantly imprinted in me that I needed to show an example for the rest. You know what I mean? It wasn't stressful to the point that it caused me stress, but it was something that's always hovering over my head that I had to. And I was just talking to my sister day before yesterday about that. This generation versus my generation, you know, as I was doing something, sometimes even if I was doing something bad, I could hear my parents' voice in the background. And you know, I could, you know, and that kept me out of a lot of things, or it stopped me from doing whatever I was doing, you know? So that's mainly what it was, you know. It was a lot. I had a really strong, tough mother. She was a businesswoman, very tactful. She went to etiquette school, something that Americans don't even talk about anymore. But my mother was one of those families that all the girls went to etiquette school. They had to know how to present themselves outside of the home, how to dress, how to, you know. So my mother's very organized, very tactful. I don't even, you know, like amongst my even cousins, my mother adopted exactly how she taught us, exactly how she was taught. You don't say mama and daddy, you say father and mother. You ask to be excused from the dinner table. And that's how I was raised. So that strictness, which was kind of not the norm, if I were to compare it to my peer circle, nobody was raised like that. So these that kind of it kind of put the training wheels for life for me. Even though I still, you know, I was a knucklehead, I still got into stuff, but I didn't get into stuff like my friends, you know.
You scared of your mom?
I was scared of my dad. I wasn't scared of my mom. I was scared of the consequence with my mom, but I was scared of my dad even knowing. With my mom, she was tough. Her punishments were tough. Especially for my generation, you know, and people, my generation from America, they were no phone for a week, no, you know, stuff like that. Which nowadays that's insane.
It's insanity. Yeah.
So, no, I was more afraid of my dad.
I think it's good to have a little bit of fear between father and son, mother and son. I think it's scary when there is no fear element.
Absolutely.
Anything goes down, you know, there's no fear.
When there's no fear, there's absolutely
right. You kind of want the kid to be looking over his shoulder. Will they find out? Will, you know, that will they find out element is enough for them to decide against what they have in mind to do, whatever that thing is.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I had parents that wouldn't, no matter. You know, I had friends that no matter what they did, their parents were on their side. They would bail them out. I didn't have those parents. If you get into trouble, you're going to have to own it.
Wow.
And so that kept me out of a lot of trouble, too.
It's good in the long run.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you kind of felt like you were on your own from a young age.
Yeah. Because I was a latchkey kid. My parents are divorced. My father was in law enforcement. When I lived with my father, he was always out of the home. So I was with my stepmom most of the time. So I had two moms. And when I was with my mother worked for IBM for 36 years. She was always working. So I was the man of the house. You know, I had a key to get in and get out. I was very much independent, but there were, you know, as I told you, my mom's very organized. So everything had to be in order by the time she got home.
What age are we talking where you had a key to your house and you were going and coming?
Oh, we're talking seven, eight. Yeah. Yeah.
My son's seven. I can't imagine him being a latchkey kid.
I can't even. Yeah. I can't. This concept is foreign to my, I couldn't imagine it. Yeah.
Do you often feel that you're lucky to be alive?
Uh, I'll put it in the context that I survived. From age 15 to about age 22, I lose count around 22 or 23 people, but I lost about 22, 23 names. After that, it gets kind of vague because they're not in my immediate circle. These people I know, but those are the amount of friends I lost to murder, not car accidents, not sickness, not, you know, these are all murders.
First degree.
Yeah. All murders.
In the span of 7 years?
Yeah. Between age 15 and age 22.
It's no joke.
Yeah. So.
So sorry to hear that.
Because I didn't join the gang, so I wasn't out there. But I had friends and associates who you still got to live life. So circles intertwine. And that's why I say I survived. Lucky to be alive? I don't know. But I would say definitely I'm a survivor. And a lot of people say that. The people that know my generation's experience, if you didn't go to prison, you didn't get shot, you got an education, you're productive, you're a survivor. Because everything was there for you to get corrupted. And I didn't grow up in the hood. I grew up in the suburbs. Okay. And I grew up with middle class parents. And still all of that was available to me.
And you weren't even in the worst areas.
No. No.
Which part of LA?
South Central LA.
South Central.
Yeah.
But that's the hood.
That's what they call it, the hood. But if you look at it, it's beautiful. It's not run down. Like I say, you're not going to find a house less than $600,000 in that area. You're not going to find a two-bedroom apartment less than $2,500 in that area. And in that area, you have the Dara Heights area, the Baldwin Hills area. Those are all $2 million, $3 million, $400 million, where the fires were.
Yeah.
These are multi, you know, this is L.A. I mean, it's not like those other cities on the East Coast, which I'm not bashing them, but it's a different lifestyle. It's a different, and even in Seattle, I lived in the suburbs.
I would imagine nothing like what LA is in terms of gang violence. Seattle just comes across as slightly more refined.
Yeah, you're right. But the thing about what drugs did is that the gangs, the Bloods and the Crips, they spread all over America. Because whatever the money they were making in LA, they could make more in Seattle.
Yeah.
They could make more in where I was born in Kansas. You know, so they spread and to what we have today.
And it infiltrated to the rap game. Bloods and the Crips became something. It was a dark time, I feel, for American history.
Yeah. Originally, the gang members that, if you go with the first generation of the LA rappers, you're talking early 80s, had nothing to do with gangs. And even if you take a group, I don't, you know, like NWA,
yeah,
their first album wasn't gangster rap, but the industry wanted to promote this idea. And with the promotion of this idea, human beings are susceptible to being influenced. And with the drug situation, and we know now through the story of Free Ray Ricky Ross, where his drug connection, he thought it was just a Colombian drug connection. Well, he was the CIA asset. And so there is a level of conspiracy here. the in Compton and Watts, which is in LA County. So we have LA County and we have LA City.
Yeah.
People will tell you the trains used to stop on the tracks and they would be open. They would have grenades, Uzis.
No way.
M16s, military grade weapons, just there.
Damn.
Yeah. And so when you put two and two together, you can get four in this scenario. So to some degree, they created a prison pipeline. Music is the influence, the drugs, the gangs sell the drugs. You create jobs. Private prison industry boomed after this. And it's just this evil cycle.
Evil cycle. But it created a pop culture renaissance.
That's
with
right.
Pac and Biggie.
Right.
And I mean, Snoop, Dre, all that era.
Mm-hmm.
That the world, white, black, yellow, whatever color, yeah. You wanted to be that. Everyone wanted to be Pac or Biggie.
That's right.
And until today, people are jamming to their music.
That's right.
How powerful is that? I mean, Pac died in 96.
That's right.
And people are still, yeah. It's crazy.
The man didn't see the age 30. I was born in Kansas, but I was raised in the West Coast. And one of the narratives that in American history that we is something that I have great interest in, especially in the last 30 years, the history of the West. We never hear the narrative of America. Everything is that we know about America pretty much is east of the Mississippi River. From 1776, almost, I won't say till now, but through those eras that you mentioned, it doesn't tell a narrative of what was going on in Seattle, Portland, Oregon, San Francisco, Los Angeles. We don't have those narratives. The only narrative we have is the 1966 LA riots.
Mm.
See, LA used to be very segregated. There used to be, I can't remember, but there was a street. And after sunset, you should not be on the other side of that street.
After Sunset Boulevard or Sunset Timing?
No. It's Sunset Timing.
Timing, okay.
So. Yeah, you couldn't be on the other side of that street. And this is the original reason why the Crips started. Because there was a high level of police brutality in Los Angeles. People were getting harmed, regular people, not criminals.
60s, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So the Crips originally started as neighborhood protection. Yeah, that's how they started. And there's a good documentary called by a former gang member. Also, somebody who became Muslim. His name is Clay Sloan, I think. Clay Sloan. He made a documentary called Bastards of the Party. And he tells a story on how during the same time as the Vietnam, that came later, but how the community protection changed right around the time when the people come back from the Vietnam War. They come back, some of them drug addicts. They come back not knowing what to do.
PTSD.
And the neighborhood protection turned into gang conflict. So originally that's why. And that's what I'm saying. These narratives, we hear about the South. We hear about people who were under different oppression in the South of America, going up north to places like New York, Chicago. If you look at the migration patterns, but my people's story is we know our story, but it's never depicted.
Mm.
You know, it's not depicted in a mainstream way.
They're ashamed of it. Is that why they're trying to bury that past?
Well, it's a different narrative.
Has to be.
It's a different narrative.
They want to show you what they want to show you.
Exactly.
Yeah. They have no problem pointing out our issues here as far as they're concerned. We're going to get into that in a second.
Yeah.
I have a question here that I didn't quite understand it, but I said I'm going to ask it to you. It was prepared by Faisal, our show manager. Why did you walk away from the golden road of the Masons? What's the golden road of the Masons?
Okay, so both of my grandfathers were high-ranking Freemasons. On my mother's side, my grandfather's brother, we call him my great uncle, he was a grandmaster of a lodge that qualifies his grandkids to be something called Joshuas. My grandfather, I saw him move like no other non-white man move. First of all, he is the first one to live on his street, non-white to live on his street, big giant, house. When my grandfather used to go grocery shopping, I used to see him order people around. He used to go back in the inventory. He'd tell him to bring him, like a flat cart. And he would say, okay, bring me this, bring me this, bring me this. And I never seen anybody do that. And I didn't understand it. And I know that one of the members of his church, in Kansas, the prison laws are straight time. If they sentence you to 20 years, you're going to do 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's not like in the West, if you do sentence 20 years, every day you do good, they give you a day.
Yeah, so good behavior.
Right.
Yeah.
They don't have that. So one of his church members, he had 40 years. He got him out after 10. And this is after he's sentenced in the prison. He sat with the judge, brotherhood, and he got him out. And I'm just giving you this background before. I didn't know that, this is all reflection, okay? I didn't know that directly or indirectly, I was kind of being groomed to go in a certain direction. In high school, I joined a group, which I didn't know is a stepping stone, called Jack and Jill. When I look back, I see the indoctrination that they were, it's kind of like an elitist mentality. When I get to college, early on, I become Muslim. This is the crossroad, because had I just joined a fraternity, that would have been the next step. So I did Jack and Jill. The next step would have been join the fraternity. The next step would have been join the lodge. And then it's easy sailing after that. All the doors will open.
Mm.
People don't really realize that I'm not going to say all of how America works, but a lot of it is like that.
That's the path.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of it is that, a lot of things that we don't understand sometimes when we read headlines in the news, a lot of times it's because of organizations, not always just Masons. Mason is just one of many organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, it was all there.
God had a different path for you.
Yeah. And I know that my grandfather, out of his grandkids, and I'm not saying that just to like boast myself up. He said this to my face more than one occasion. He wanted me to carry on his path. So when I become Muslim, me and my grandfather, we had a lot of, religious discourse. I wouldn't call it a debate, but going back and forth on these issues all the way up until maybe a month before he passed away.
Wow. Do you ever like look back and feel thankful for the path you ended up taking versus the one that you could have taken if you continued your indoctrination in the system that you were in?
Yeah, I think Allah, yes, absolutely. You know, this is, of course, this is why some people that know me would say he's insane. But I'm happy where I'm at. Yes, all of those people that I know, that I grew up with, that went that route, they're fine. Financially fine. Everything is on the up and up. But my soul is at peace. And I didn't become Muslim in a time where it was popular to become Muslim. And I didn't become Muslim by the influence of others. I studied the religion. I was a student in college. I looked at it from an academic prince, from an academic stance. And I said, this is my faith, and that's it. And even after the major event that I'm sure we'll get to happened, there were people saying, you see where this got you? But that didn't deter me, because I told, I'm at peace here, you know, and that's all that counts. I think there's a lot of people that have a lot of money, a lot of access to money, a lot of access to things that aren't at peace. Actually, I know a many personally that they can snap their fingers right now and spend $1 million.
Hmm.
But I know he's not happy. He's not at peace. Not happy, excuse me. He's not at peace. And not only is he not at peace, he doesn't know how to get it. And that's worse. It's one thing to not have it. But maybe you don't have it, but you know how to get there. You know, it's a struggle, it's a trial, but you can get there. But what about if you don't even know? That's, I wouldn't want that.
I think those are the poorest people in the world.
Absolutely. I agree. I agree.
It's an article written at ACLU article,
mm-hmm.
with a subject that said federal court calls FBI to account for the unlawful imprisonment of U.S. citizen Abdullah Al-Kid, being wrongfully accused for a crime you never committed. Put in jail. This was all around the 9/11 era.
Right.
What kind of emotions were going through your head at the time when you were being accused on a federal level of something that you've never done?
To be honest, it's hard to articulate, because everything just is like a snowball. So the arrest threw me off guard, knocked the wind out of my chest, literally. And it's like you're in a movie that you're not the director and you're not an actor with the script. The script has been handed to you. So the real emotions didn't come out of me until I get, there's a process. I get arrested in Virginia. I was on my way here. So I get arrested in Virginia. I stay there for, I think, like 7 or 8 days. Then they send me to Oklahoma Transit Center. And then they send me to Boise, Idaho. And I think when I get to Boise and I get interrogated a couple of times, that's when it like hit me. And I'm like, man, these guys are just trying to railroad me. They don't care about me. This is just nothing to them. I'm just a notch on his belt.
That's a great realization to have.
Yeah. And at the same time, I don't harbor any feelings to what I'm about to say now. Some of the responses I was getting from certain people that I expected to be supportive of me were not what I expected it was. And that really sent me into dark places, emotionally. And when I say dark places, I don't mean like, it just hurt really bad. Just hurt really, 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 really bad. You're talking about friends and family, people that you hold high in your heart and in your mind. And when something like that happens, you're expecting people to not be affected by the media. You're expecting people, well, I know this guy. This doesn't make sense. It's like one of my best friends. He called my mom. This guy's not Muslim. He's a guy I've known since the third grade. And he called my mother crying. He said, what are they doing to my friend? Yet and still, there's other people that know me just like he does. And they were affected by it. And they treated me differently. And some people didn't want to support me. And some people, when they read material witness in the media, oh, he's just a witness. It's not a big deal. But they didn't know that the government arrested me as a material witness in order to investigate me for a crime so they could charge me. And that's why they ran in the media this dark image of myself. So that was the really, like, when I was locked up, that was the hardest thing for me at that time, because it's like you're looking for a lifeline, even if it's just a word of support. And certain people at that moment, they didn't come through for me.
That hurts the most.
Yeah. Today, I've let that go. And I understand that in order to get to the guy you're in front of now, I had to have that moment. I had to have that moment. I had to get burned. I had to get the acid test. I had to be tested. I had to come to who I am today. I don't know if I would have came to this guy without that. I had to find out who are the people who really stand by you. I had to learn what the meaning of a real friend and a real relationship is. I had to learn the difference between a friend and an associate. A person that you may admire and enjoy and spend time with may not really be your friend. And I had to learn that although we share the same blood, that they are just as susceptible to the media as anyone else. Even though they know me, we have the same blood, but they're just as susceptible to the media as anyone else. And that's a hard pill to swallow at the moment, because you're thinking, oh, man, you know me. I mean, you can call me and you can talk, but, you know, I had to go through that.
Is it still, because I see how passionate you still are and however many years it's been since, does it still boil your blood when you think about those who didn't have your back?
If it's not anger, disappointment. If it's family, disappointed, but I got over that. Friends, of course, we're not the same anymore. We're not friends anymore.
Yeah.
We're not friends, because anybody who's been a friend with me knows I'm loyal to the end. I'm loyal to my fault with my friends. Everybody knows that. So, the thing that bothers me is it does, I wouldn't say boil, but the thing that really bothers me is the people that through all of these years, haven't made an effort to understand from my point of view, and you still have comments about the situation.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense to me, and it's not acceptable.
That's where I wanted to go, is has the system improved since, you know, you were wrongfully detained, accused, you know, your name dragged through the mud when it didn't have to be. Do you think there's genuine will to address this abuse of power that we're seeing in some respect, whereby the next person doesn't have to go through what you went through? You know, the system, I don't want to say is, obviously there's always mistakes, but I think a little bit more can be done for the sake of not going down the path of injustices the way you did.
Yeah, this is one thing I learned through going through this ordeal, is that a lot of Americans, regardless of faith and political positions, don't want to see people mistreated. And that's what I learned through this process. And especially in the legal world, you know, I didn't realize how big my case was legally in the field of law. It's like huge, even up into this day. So, you know, there's a lot of constitutionalists, is what they call them, and they're not going to go for that. And that, and I, you know, that's the thing that I'm really proud, and I was amazed, and even I was shocked by certain you know, people that spoke favorably of me at the time. And I was really shocked, like, by certain individuals that spoke in my favor, that are like, you know, political ideologues in it. So I was really shocked. Yeah, I think so. I mean, but, you know, just the nature of American political system, not the law, but the political system, who knows what could happen in the future. But I know at least now they can't use the material witness as an investigation tool, and they can't treat a material witness like a criminal, you know, and thanks to my lawsuit, alhamdulillah.
What made you decide that enough was enough and you wanted to leave the U.S.?
That situation handicapped me severely. I mean, anybody could Google my name. And at that time, if you talk pre-2008, I mean, you're not going to see that I won a lawsuit. You see, you're going to see that I was arrested. And with the cloud of suspicion of terrorism attached to it. Okay. So I was handicapped, and you know, I drove cab, I moved furniture, I was a delivery guy because I couldn't get a job.
I was going to say, you become unemployable.
Yeah. And there's, you know, without explicit details, there were behind the scenes things that were happening to prevent me from getting a job. Oh yeah. So, you know, it's not just that I couldn't get a job because of somebody can Google my name. No, there's a hidden hand at play. It's in some of our documents for my lawsuit that was happening. You know, I would get hired from a job. I'm talking about hired. And before I show up for the first day, I'd get a phone call and say, "I'm sorry, Mr. Al-Kid, but you're not going to be able to come in for work today." And I'd be like, "Why?" "Well, I'm sorry, I can't tell you that."
Oh. So you had enough? And Saudi is where you had your eyes on?
Well, I knew that when I got arrested, I was on my way here anyway. I had a scholarship.
I was going to ask you, did they barge into your house or was it in the airport?
It was in the airport.
Huh.
Yeah. So I had a scholarship to study here. So the idea of living and working or studying in Saudi was already an option. So I was teaching at the time, and I was just spinning my tires. I mean, I'm just paying bills. I'm just existing. I'm not getting anywhere. It was a very fulfilling job, but I'm not getting anywhere. And so I applied for a job, and I said, listen, I'll just apply for a job and see what happens.
Yeah.
And so when it came up, I talked to my lawyer. I prayed about it. My lawyer said, I think we can do it. You think you can continue the lawsuit from over there? I think my last personal appearance in a court setting was in one of the settlement negotiations in 2008, which we didn't settle. And after that, August 2008, I was here.
Hmm. Been back since?
Oh yeah.
So no problem getting in and out?
No. But sometimes when you check in to on a plane, sometimes it gets some issues.
Mm-hmm. All charges have been dropped, and it's not even on your record.
Well, I was never charged with a crime. So the material witness statute allows the federal government to detain you and arrest you without any charges. So I was never charged with a crime. So material witness was a law that was created in the, if I'm not mistaken, in the 1920s. And it was created for the mob and the mafia. And because they were afraid that witnesses would not testify against their cohorts. So basically, a material witness means that this person has information valuable to the case against someone else. They knew, I knew, and we discovered this in our lawsuit, there is nothing that I had of value for their case against another person. I had nothing. And they knew that. But they still decided to arrest me. And the reason why they arrested me, not because they wanted me to testify or to give information in that case, is because they wanted to investigate me. They wanted to charge me with a crime, but they had nothing. Because I've never, ever, ever been affiliated with anything closely, remotely related to terrorists.
Well, that brings me to my next point. Is it because of your Muslim background? And can we ever hope to break free from these Muslim stereotype?
I don't want to speak for the the intelligence community or the law enforcement community, but from my assessment, my humble assessment, it appears that at that particular time, it was based on guilty by association.
Okay.
And as transient as masajid are and mosques are, and how Islamic activities work in America, guilty by association is just too vague. It's too loose of a concept, and it's too vague. They never, because I follow ever from going to this, I followed a lot of cases. I would download the court transcripts and read and try to understand. Once I went through this, I like basically self-educated myself on this stuff. And my case, they never would ever be able to find an audio recording or emails or anything that would say, we need to take care of this guy. This guy is going to certain websites, and that my case isn't like that.
So then who were they afraid of you being associated with? What did they have on you?
Well, I used to, you can decide later on how, okay. So I used to work for a nonprofit organization called Al-Muttaqa Al-Islami. It was founded by a Nigerian student from University of Washington. And he was basically, at this, if in the 90s, Islamic conferences were big. It's starting to pick up again, but in the 90s were huge. You know, scholars and students from Saudi, from Egypt, from Yemen, from all over the world were coming to United States to teach Islam. And Al-Muntaq al-Islami was one of those people who used to record, sometimes translate, and they had an English and Arabic section. And so I used to work in the English as a volunteer. Actually, from the first time I became Muslim, I mean, like early in my early stages of Islam, I was volunteering for Al-Muntaq al-Islami. They used to put on a kids camp every summer. We would get all the kids and have a Quran competition, go fishing, canoeing, exercise, all this kind of like
social
fun stuff. Yeah, for like a week. So I used to do that. I used to go from different mosques, selling the tapes, and of course the English one. So around, I want to say, 1999, 2000, the guy who founded Al-Muntaqa, he gets a job with Microsoft and he puts everything in storage. And some students that were attending the University of Idaho say, hey, we want to make dawah. Let's get all this stuff up. So I get back to Idaho. I graduated, but I get back to Idaho to be involved with Al-Muntaqa again. But I'm in the English section. So I was in charge of all of the English stuff. And that's my relationship with Al-Muntaqa. Al-Muntaqa, somewhere around 2000, they get under the umbrella of an organization called IANA, Islamic Assembly of North America. Okay. And at that time, I didn't know their reality or reality of certain people. And I'll just say, for far as I know, they were never associated with anything, but they're kind of into politics. You know how that's kind of like tricky. So for that reason, or other reasons, this is how I know it, they're being watched. And I had no idea about that because I'm not, at that particular time, I can't speak Arabic, can't read Arabic, I don't know anything. I'm just all into the English stuff. And so around the turn of the millennium, 2000 comes, 2001 comes, I want to learn Arabic. So I go to Yemen.
Yemen?
Yeah. I go to Yemen, Sana'a. And at the time, it was popular. All the way from the mid-90s, people from America were going to Egypt and Yemen because it was cheap, it was easy. So they were going to these two places because they wanted to learn Arabic and it was cheap. You know, you could save, I know guys that saved up money, a good size amount of money, not a lot of amount of money, enough to last them like a year or two. They pay a rent, full year, and they would just study Arabic, learn how to read the Quran, and then come back to America.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I was part of this crowd in 2001. And so 6 months prior to me going to Yemen, there is a famous elder of ours, American Dai in America. He advised me on the phone. He said, Brother Abdullah, the people that you're remotely associated with are involved in like politics, and I'm going to send you some stuff. I want you to read it and study it. You need to free yourself of these people. He said, because to dress Islam or dress politics in the guise of Islam is wrong.
Hmm.
He said, these guys are doing something that they wouldn't be able to do in their own countries. He said, why are they using America as a platform to do it? He said, you said, you're a good Muslim. You just want to know your religion and you want to help people learn the religion. So just do that. So I stopped my work with Al-Muntaqa 6 months before traveling to Yemen. And I got a job. And I'm still social with the brothers and everything, but I'm not dealing with this anymore. Now, strange things happened to me in Yemen as well. Because I ended up leaving there early because of, I kind of got, I won't say beat up, but semi-tortured by the Ba'ath Party that was in Yemen. And so after that, 2 days after I got out of that situation, I'm out of there. I went back home. Little did I know that the FBI had been investigating these guys who were on the Arabic side of Al-Muntaqa and Ayana, Islamic Assembly of North America.
Okay, but why did they beat you up or do something along those lines?
You mean back in Yemen?
Yeah.
Okay, so the Ba'ath Party, what they were doing...
The audience will kill me if I didn't follow up with that question.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the Ba'ath Party at that particular time was big. We're trying to make a big push in Sana'a. And they didn't like foreign Muslims.
Foreign?
Yeah, he said to my face. He said, if you're not Muslim, he said, I'll roll the red carpet out for you. He said, because you're Muslim and you came here to study Islam, we don't want you here.
Wow.
Yeah. He said that to my face.
I wonder why.
And he said that in front of an American attaché.
Wow.
Yes, from the U.S. Embassy. Because those are the guys that they so basically, if you were a foreigner, and you know, if you go back in that time, it was happening to non-Muslims as well. You know, like somebody would kidnap a foreigner in Yemen and they would hold him ransom. That wasn't my case, but what was happening was is if any Muslim foreigner who was staying in a hotel, and I was actually waiting to get, see, I've been trying to get to Saudi, so I was waiting for a visa to come. I was going to leave Saudi, I mean, leave Yemen and go to Saudi. And that's why I was in a hotel. And I'm calling this guy as the visa, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. I said, look, man, it's not safe to be in the hotel here. So I end up getting, What they're doing is the guys in the hotels will get kickbacks, financial kickbacks from the police if they catch a foreigner.
Hmm.
So I saw Americans, French guys, UK guys from the UK get arrested. You'd hear stories. And everybody would say, you know, always stay out of the hotels. So that's basically how they arrested me. Not for any crime or anything like that. They just arrested me. And then they took some of my stuff out of my hotel room. And I had to call the U.S. Embassy to kind of, you know, persuade them to give me my stuff back. And that's when he said it in front of my face. He's like, if you were a non-Muslim, I would roll out the red carpet.
Wow.
Yeah. So I get back to America. And then this is how I find out that these guys, well, I didn't know at the time, but eventually I find out that these guys are being investigated. But when I come back, I don't go back to Idaho. I'm back in Seattle.
Okay.
And so maybe 3 weeks after being back in Seattle, FBI knocks on my door. And me, believing in this, like a lot of people, well, I didn't do anything. Come on inside. And so I invite him inside. I tell him, answer their questions. I tell him my, I don't want to say ideology, but my, the way I believe and view and practice Islam. I brought them books to show. Hey, look, man, I know who you're looking for.
I'm not him.
And I'm the guy that maybe him wants to hurt. You know what I mean? Because I'm not with that.
Okay? The extremist.
Yeah. I'm not with that at all. And I like brought material for them to show this is where I'm at.
They weren't convinced?
Well, actually, under deposition, my lawyer, because once I put up the lawsuit, my lawyer is able to depose all the people, Okay. So that guy, he said, from the first time I sat down with Abdullah, I knew he wasn't who we were looking for.
Hmm.
But he's not the boss.
It's bad luck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who were the Aryans, if I'm pronouncing it right, and how did they save your life in prison?
Okay. So when I was a chaplain, the Aryan brothers, okay, so the prison in the West Coast are very segregated. You got the Aryan Brotherhood, you have the blacks, you have the Mexican Mafia, and there's some subgroups under that. So, on all of these groups, there's some subgroups, but these are the three main. And Muslims kind of are like a hybrid group of their own, not falling into anything. Some guys from a group that, you know, we don't consider to be Muslims, Nation of Islam, this racist group, they wanted me to bring some of their materials in. And I told them, no, I'm not going to bring your materials. I can bring you Quran, and I can bring you prayer rugs, and I can bring you stuff on how to pray and fast and all these kind of stuff, but I can't bring in your books. And they got angry, and they put a hit on me to get stabbed, you know. And so it spread around the prison. And the Aryan Brotherhood, at the same time, there was a mass lockdown on all the West Coast prisons for the Aryan Brotherhood. And one of the sections of the prison is called administrative segregation. It's what we think of as when you call the whole, okay? And so all the Aryan Brotherhoods are all locked. They're all locked down. And aside from me working with the Muslims, you also have to be like a counselor to all inmates. So I walked the tiers. Okay. And so one day I was in the hole, or the administrative segregation. I'm walking the tiers. And this particular day I was wearing a thobe. And I walked down, and one of the Aryan Brotherhood guys said, "Whoa, I think I saw an angel." And I go, I said, "No, I'm not an angel. What are you talking about?" He said, "Oh, you're wearing this. That looks nice." And I said, "What's going on with you guys?" He's like, "Man, the administration has come down on us. We got a whole lockdown, and that's the beginning of the relationship." So from that, every Friday, I made sure I would walk the tier and add seg where the ABs are and talk to them. And I'm like, "Man, you need anything? I'll talk to administration to get it to you, because I know you guys are locked down." And from that relationship, they say, "Look, I hear the Nation of Islam guys got a hit on you. They ain't going to touch you because we got you." And that's just a lesson in not letting stereotypes stop you from establishing a human-to-human relationship.
Yeah.
A human-to-human interaction. Here I am, a Muslim, wearing a thobe. Here he is, Aryan Brotherhood, and he's granting me protection.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That you found, you know, some people to really help you through that time.
Yeah.
If you didn't, would have your life been in jeopardy?
It's a potential. Absolutely, it's potential, because the Muslims can't be everywhere, you know. And like I say, there's underneath the, they call it a car. Underneath the black car, you still have subgroups. You have Crips, you have Bloods, you have all these other things that could still fall underneath that. So it's easy for, if you don't have a protection by a strong group, and like I said, Muslims are not that big. They're not as big as these Aryan Brotherhood. It's easy for anybody to attack you.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no, you know, I didn't have an escort, you know, there's classes of people, and I had the second to the highest class. So I could basically go anywhere in the prison. So it could happen anytime, you know.
It's my biggest fear in life. Well, not because, you know, I could be killed, or obviously that's a disaster for me, but it's the lack of freedom. It's the being put in a, you know, 2 by 2 meter room.
Oh,
you can't leave. I mean, that's the worst. I get memories of my mom like punishing me for like an hour or two. I'd lose my mind.
Yeah.
I think it's, I mean, when it comes down to it, like that's like the biggest gift of life, right? Is your freedom.
Yes.
We look at the Palestinians and the word, you know, the freedom is very synonymous with the word Palestine. Free Palestine is probably the most said compound word of the last 2 years, as it should be.
That's right.
But yeah, losing your freedom, and especially if you're in there like on a false accusation, it's just, I mean, were you able to sleep? You know, were you able to think? How did you operate? You probably lost mad weight. You probably, you know, anxieties, all of that nasty stuff, you know?
All of what you said, yeah. I think in Idaho, I almost went crazy. I started counting ants. Yeah. I started counting ants. I started placing food in a certain way to where they wouldn't bother me. You know, I used to have random bursts of tears. So I would just be normal, just like how we're talking now. And then it would just, you know, and I had that for years after that too.
That's a mental health.
Well, I'm diagnosed with PTSD.
PTSD, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I'm diagnosed, yeah.
The early days.
From this incident.
From that incident.
Yeah, yeah.
Not from a younger age. No. Central.
Well, I mean, I probably do have a level of PTSD in terms of being exposed to violence, yes. But this right here, I mean, that PTSD is different. You're talking about heart palpitations. You're talking about nightmares, but nightmares in the commonly understood sense. Nightmares where you're innocent, so you have this whole movie. They're all different, but you're innocent, being charged guilty. And I just had this over and over and over, all the way up until, you know, I used to have them as frequent as 3 to 5 times a week to 2008 when I moved here, maybe 3 times a month.
Wow.
To where now it doesn't exist. I don't get those dreams anymore.
Thank God.
Yeah. I mean, you have a dream where you wake up crying, you wake up with your hands like this. Can you imagine wake up with your hands like this?
Because you think you're cuffed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So glad that it took its course, you know, time heals everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a question that came from one of the team members. I'm just going to read it out verbatim. Mm. Social media has amplified both awareness and misinformation. How do you navigate the line between being an effective voice for justice and dealing with the toxicity and backlash that often accompanies online activism? It's a mouthful.
Yeah. Well, I don't have really a voice on online, but backlash, I'm built for that. If I ever became a voice of activism.
Your voice right now.
Well, I'm ready for the backlash.
Yeah.
Cause I'm this is the sports side of Abdullah. I'm built for combat, mentally built for combat.
Were you a linebacker?
I was a running back.
Running
back. Yeah.
That was my next guess.
Yeah. So I know that being in front of people, having a voice, a public voice, it comes with criticism. It comes with a backlash. And it's just part of the game. You can't please everybody. And I think that if you stand on what you believe in and you're sincere, it's part of the game.
What is it? Stand for something or die for nothing?
That's right.
Love that shit.
That's right. Hmm. That's right. So, and I always tell people, you know, now that I'm at this age, I'm a teacher and I'm a coach. When the truth is on your side, fear nothing.
Yeah.
But I had to go through that to get to that point. Because I don't think I might have said that. Or maybe not with the amount of conviction that I have now. And I tell this to guys all the time. Because I know a lot of stories similar to mine and worse. And I always give them a scenario. I said, what if someone threatened to take you away from your kids, your wife, your livelihood, but the key to this is if you move with fear, you're gonna lose integrity. So is your fear greater than your truth or your integrity? And with me, because of what I went through, I know that in the realm of law enforcement and all of that, they're going to do whatever they want to do. It doesn't matter about
me. Out of your control.
So it's out of your control. So if you stand on your truth, yeah, and you have to look at history of all those who stood on their truth, most of them were fought against. Okay? So it comes with that. If you're gonna, and I always tell people, when you're doing good things, you have to be able to take glory and pain in the same vein. Glory and pain has to come in the same vein. It's not that when something bad happens to me now, it takes me off my mission. So if I had a voice in activism, bring it on.
I normally leave this question to the end, but would you remove anything from your timeline that you've been through, the negatives? Would you rather that you didn't go through it, or do you feel that everything is a stepping stone, battle stripes, etc., to the person that you've become today?
I wouldn't remove anything. No, I wouldn't remove anything. But I could say that some of my decisions and my reactions to that situation were not the best. But I mean, that's just part of life. You're not going to always make the right decisions, and you learn from that. So I'm going to say no, no. But I do recognize that some things that I did, some decisions I made weren't to my advantage. But in the end, I get the advantage of learning from the mistake.
Yeah. Makes you more resilient.
Yeah.
You once said the brotherhood of Islam let you down. Now, that could be a bit misleading for people who read that as a headline.
Not the brotherhood that is described in Islam. It's a beautiful thing, and you long for that. And I always tell people that as a new Muslim, we have, especially with a lot of Western Muslims that went through, you know, reverting to Islam, we have this this Islamic utopia in our mind that doesn't exist, because at the end of the day, we're all human beings, you know? And so that statement needs to be in context. What it means is that the people that I loved and adored as brothers. When trauma hit, the brotherhood fractured.
Mm.
It's not Islam's problem, it's the people's problem. Because what Islam described for brotherhood is beautiful. It's amazing. I mean, and anybody who's listening to this, just go look at Times Square, Taraweeh prayer.
I saw a video 2 days ago.
You see what I'm saying?
I thought it was CGI.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Unbelievable.
Come on, man. This is what I'm talking about. So when trauma hits, where's our brotherhood?
Mm.
And that's what let me down. It let me down. People that, like, again, people that I loved, held high in respect. When trauma hits, you tuck your tail. That's what I meant by the statement, you know.
Get that.
That bothers me, because I will stand with my brother to the end.
Good or bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's brotherhood.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, I get it now. You felt that you were let down.
Yeah.
By those who should have had your back.
Yeah.
Led you to believe that they had your back.
Yeah. On the principle that I'm your Muslim brother.
Yep.
And that look, you're your Muslim brother. He didn't do anything wrong. He's being victimized right now. He's being oppressed. And you tuck your tail?
Yeah. That's not it.
Nah, that's not it.
About the Taraweeh in Times Square, I was thinking the other day, how did the mayor or the city of New York, how did they approve that?
It blows my mind.
Like, it's not Boise, Idaho. It's it's Manhattan Times Square that many would argue, you know, is the center of, like, you know,
yeah,
the shopping world.
Commerce and all that. SubhanAllah. Yeah.
It was crazy. Like, I saw maybe 1,000 people, and I could be underselling it, praying Taraweeh, microphones, imam, you can hear it. Beautiful voice too.
Yeah.
I really wanted to be in New York City at that moment in time.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like something you put on the bucket list.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you wouldn't expect it.
Yeah.
They flipped Times Square to a mosque, outdoor mosque.
Yeah.
I wonder how much it rattled the non-Muslim people of New York, or if they were like, oh, you know, to each their own. I wonder where they stand today with such an image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's like happening. I know at least the last 2 or 3 years I've seen it. And I just saw it just again this year. It's amazing.
How has classism let you down?
Has classism let me down? I think the biggest thing for Americans is to understand that above racism is classism. We're taught that racism is above classism. No, it's the opposite. And I didn't know that growing up.
Mm.
Because race is kind of forced down your throat in America.
Yeah.
But really, the thing of it is, it's a classist society. You can always find people who break the barriers of racism through classism. And that's another thing that, again, is not talked about. I think that's the biggest thing about me, is that growing up, I didn't know that classism has more weight than racism.
I've never heard it put that way, but I can certainly see what you mean.
Yeah, it's like I heard one guy said, racism is for the lower class to you know, the people on the upper scale, let's say the top 10%, it's about classism.
Yeah, the elitists.
Yeah. It's about classism. It's not about necessarily about race.
Yeah.
At that level, people at the bottom are scrambling and arguing and bickering and putting up walls.
Do you ever think about writing a book?
I'm in the process of it. It's just difficult for me. I'm seeking out I made contact with a really big writer right now. And he's got a project he has to finish and one after, but we're in talks right now to help. I've written about 65% of it.
Wow.
And writing is an art. You need this creative space. And I have a problem when I write, and that is, my mind is able to project a movie even with my eyes open. Like, mm-hmm. I could be sitting in front of the computer, and as I'm recounting parts of my life, my hands will freeze and the movie will start to play. And this is my biggest hang up with writing the book. That's why it's taken me so long. But the blessing of it is how much personal development I've had, because if you would have talked to me around 2008, 2009-ish, no, even before, 2004, 2005, around this time, the book would have had a certain theme with it. And then if you would have moved to 2008 to about 2012, it would have had another theme, to where now I think it's in this best moments, because there's certain things that I wanted to say that I no longer want to say.
Some maturity?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were certain things that I wanted to include in the book, but I personally believe for the wrong reasons. And I'm glad I got that out of my system.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now I just want to tell my story like my first intention, which was my very first memory, all the way up into the event and the aftermath of the event.
Do you have a title in mind? Don't tell me, but do you have one in mind?
No. That's something I'm swimming around. I've had different ones in, but, you know, I don't know.
That'll do well. It's a story.
Yeah.
Do you ever see yourself moving back to the West? Or are you happy in Saudi?
I'm happy in Saudi. I think about it a lot. I just don't know how. You know, so much time has passed. The economy is different over there. I basically have to reinvent myself. I would have to reinvent myself. Teaching over there would probably get me by initially, but I don't know that I want to continue teaching if I were to go back home. I don't, it's not something that's like, I don't have a plan or anything like that.
You know? If it's not teaching, what would you like to, like, what else is there out there for you that you'd like to do, explore? Would you get into sports?
Well, I'm coaching now. I could see myself coaching. To be honest, I really don't know. To be honest, I don't know what I would do.
Hmm.
What I would like to do?
Yeah.
Maybe go back to something old that I wanted to do, and that's just maybe be a documentary filmmaker.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's so many stories to tell.
Oh, yeah.
There's so much material I can provide, and I really want to make it. If I did that, I would really want to do it. My target market would be Muslims, the Muslim world. It's for everybody, but I want to tell a narrative about America that the average Muslim, no matter what country you're in, you don't know it.
Yeah.
It's not readily available for you. And I would like to do that. And not to mention, I would like to do it on the reverse as well.
How so?
A lot of Americans don't understand Muslims. They don't understand some aspects about Islam. They don't understand about some aspects of how the cultural differences between different Muslim countries. And it would be a great opportunity to build a bridge.
You know what I love about that? Is that you don't need a multi-million dollar production to do something that can fly off the shelf.
Right.
You have these low budget pictures that are winning awards in some of the biggest film festivals in the world.
That's right. That's right.
It's become democratized almost, where it's not just, you know, the three or four biggest production studios that can make you elite documentaries.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There are some foot soldiers that can create something compelling and can resonate with the world and be translated in 40 languages, and everyone knows about that story.
There you go.
So I say that to perhaps maybe encourage you to go for it.
Sharp.
You know? What about legacy? I'll close with this. What do you want your legacy to be when people hear your name? Think of your name.
Oh, man, that's deep.
Left the deepest for the last.
What is my legacy? You know, when people think about Abdullah after he's gone, just think about a sincere man. You know, all my interactions are sincere based, from coaching to teaching. This is why when I teach younger guys, going back to the statement that you have to take glory and pain at the same time, if you're going to be a sincere person, a lot of people are going to going to disappoint you. And I think the one thing that defines Abdullah is sincerity. Very sincere to everybody around me.
It's a beautiful trait. Maybe lacking in the world we're living in today. Sincerity. There's a lot of ego, me, me, me. What can I do for me and myself and I? Maybe a little less on the sincerity side. So I really do appreciate that being something that you want to resonate with people as a legacy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Abdullah.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your story. Really appreciate this.
Thank you. Thank you.
Opening up and being vulnerable and, you know, talking about things that clearly, I think, maybe made you feel a little uncomfortable, you know, remembering negative memories and all that. But
I almost got caught up with my friend calling my mom, but yeah, that's emotional, a little bit emotional. Certain things are really emotional about that situation, but alhamdulillah.
I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
And good luck. And really do think about the dream of wanting to, you know, get into production and documentary.
Yeah.
I had a job that I was not happy in. And then when COVID hit, I was like, we don't have a Joe Rogan in the Middle East. Let me give it a shot. And 145 episodes later, almost 5 years,
Mashallah.
I do this for a living now. Alhamdulillah.
Mashallah.
So dreams do come true.
That's true.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Ramadan Mubarak.
Ramadan Mubarak. Appreciate it. Thank you. I appreciate it so much. Mr. Paul, very best. You guys like that?